Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Both hours today, open forum. You can call and ask Joe whatever you like. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-31-TRUTH. And I am undecided about the first hour. Who do you think, which do you think made more people mad? Our derision of the baby boomers or our, not derision, but...
historically accurate.
Accurate statements about the Aztecs. Yes. Which do you think made more people mad?
I think maybe the latter, based on what the screeners were telling us over the break in terms of people calling in upset. I think the boomers have gotten the okay boomer jokes for so long now that it's just lost some of its.
They're just chill. They're just having their flashbacks and doing what they're doing for the day. So they're probably not mad. But yeah, I think as someone who called misunderstood what you said and thought you said that all Mexicans are Aztecs, but what you said was the Aztecs are now Mexicans.
Like exactly.
The descendants of the Aztecs.
The area of what was then Tenochtitlan, it's now Mexico City.
Yeah.
It was founded by the Mexica Aztecs, which is where we get the word Mexico from. But there were a lot of surrounding tribes, many of whom were the victims of the Aztecs. And as I mentioned before, helped overthrow the Aztecs, helped the Spanish actually topple Tenochtitlan, helped them, rid of the Aztec Empire. So it certainly is not true that there's like a one-to-one correspondence, but
no,
if you were to say what would happen to the Aztecs, which was the question, well, they became Mexicans.
And that city that they built really was an engineering marvel. And so sometimes you hear, well, they were more advanced than the Europeans, which is, I mean, probably true in certain engineering senses, but mostly technologically not more advanced. But they on a single day cut out the hearts of 40,000 innocent people. It's like saying, yeah. I'm sorry to say this, but this is how I interpret that.
The Germans built the Autobahn.
Hitler made the trains run on time, or Mussolini made the trains run on time. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
But that one thing does not compensate
right.
for the another.
Being good at technology and bad at human rights is not an unheard of combination in the modern world.
No. Speaking of this, maybe now you're talking about our own society.
See where it was made. So,
yeah. Right. Being technologically advanced does not balance out immorality. That is the problem with our culture today. We're more advanced than any other. In what sense are we more advanced? Certainly not morally more advanced.
Yeah, I studied a little bit of the Aztecs in college, and it's actually really fascinating because there did seem to be a sort of haunted conscience that the Aztecs had about some of their abuses. They didn't seem particularly bothered by the human sacrifice, but one of the priests that they'd actually exiled, they sent him in a boat and sent him out to sea to die. And the people had this idea, there was kind of a folk belief that he was going to return, and he might return with a vengeance. And so when the Spaniards land, initially they thought it was him returning. And that he was coming to wreak, like, basically divine vengeance upon them for their sins. And so they had a sense that, like, maybe they'd done something wrong, and this was divine punishment for what they'd done. So they didn't just say, well, we're totally innocent. We've done nothing wrong. There is an awareness.
That is a repeating historical theme. A repeating theme of history is whenever something bad happens to any population, the question is, what have we done? What did we
do? This is what St. Augustine is asking in City of God.
Yeah.
Rome is falling, and the pagans are saying, this is our fault for becoming Christians. And, you know, we were a great empire, then we became Christian, and now we're terrible. And Augustine said, no, this is a problem of you not being Christian enough, that you have been lukewarm, that you've been following the city of man rather than the city of God.
But then Gibbon became a best-selling author by proposing the pagan hypothesis again in the 19th century.
Yeah. He just reinvents that and is like, oh, look at this brilliant new idea.
I think the pagans were right. 888-318-7884, the number. It's an open forum. Allison's in Canada listening on Catholic.com. That's our website. We hope you check it out, Catholic.com. Allison, thank you very much for waiting while we rehashed our unpopular comments from the first hour. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. So my question is, I was at church on Sunday, and the priest was discussing the Palm Sunday gospel reading, and he said that some of the people who were welcoming Jesus into Jerusalem, like when the people are spreading their cloaks on the road, might actually be some of the same people later demanding that Pilate crucify Jesus. So if that is the case, then how and why did attitudes just among the general public towards Jesus shift so suddenly?
Yeah, that is a great question. Because this, so there's a lot of question about what people at the time of Jesus thought the Messiah was going to do for them. But one common theme is that he was going to vanquish Israel's enemies. And so if you're someone in Jerusalem and you are fed up with the Romans, or you're fed up even with the high priest and kind of the existing temple structure in Jerusalem, then the idea of an upending kind of Messiah, that sounds really exciting. But then when you see him arrested and he no longer looks powerful in a worldly sense, then it's easy to turn against him and say, what a failure. I can't believe we were had. You know, we've been led into, you know, this era. And the truth is, Jesus is coming to vanquish Israel's enemies. But the slavery they were in wasn't ultimately Roman slavery. It was demonic slavery. That the devil is the major enemy of Israel, as the devil is the major enemy of all of us today. That the political oppression and everything else is an echo of the spiritual oppression that we have most to be worried about. And so in that sense, he doesn't seem to be the kind of Messiah they wanted. When they yell out Hosanna, that means save us or give salvation. But the kind of saving they wanted seems to have been political salvation, not spiritual. And so I think about this somewhat regularly, because, I mean, really, you only need to look at politics, how quickly we can turn large groups of people to say, oh, well, I believed in this a week ago, I believe in this now, or I liked this candidate then, but now they look silly and now I'm going to join in mocking them. That sort of thing is very startling, easy to do. And so in that sense, it reveals something of the weakness of the human heart, that the ordinary person is willing to be led along by whatever the fads and the currents of the day are. If they're for Christ, with him. If they're against Christ, against him. What do you think, Allison?
Yeah, I think that definitely makes sense of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. Thanks very much for the call. And I know we kept you waiting a while, so thank you very much for your patience and waiting. I'm going to go to Madison, Wisconsin now. Andy in Madison, Wisconsin, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Andy, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yep. I actually thought you were going to take me the last caller because you led into my call so perfectly with mentioning City of God.
Oh, yeah. An unintentional segue, but a good one. Yeah.
So in the foreword to the Penguin's classic edition of City of God, the author or the whoever wrote the foreword said that St. Augustine was displaying all of the typical signs of someone on the steps of metanoia or like conversion of heart. But he doesn't elaborate what those are. So can you tell me, like, what are those signs of someone on the, like, on the verge of metanoia?
I see. So, okay, I want to caveat this by saying I don't have the version of City of God with that introduction in front of me, and I don't know the context in which he's saying that. I can say that we see St. Augustine is hungry. Like, if you, especially if you read the Confessions, he describes this, that he's hungry, he's searching, and he's not finding what he's looking for in worldly pleasures. And then he starts looking in worldly philosophies. And so he becomes like a Manichaean, basically. And then you see that he's not satisfied with that as well. And then he starts listening to St. Ambrose of Milan, the famous preacher, preach. And so we see this kind of progression where, okay, worldly pleasure isn't satisfying me. Worldly wisdom isn't satisfying me. Christianity seems to have something interesting to offer. So in those cases, when he finally converts, we can see it as kind of the end point of a trajectory. Now, I'm not saying everybody who converts has that, and I don't know without having the text in front of me if that's what the author has in mind. But in St. Augustine's own case, I think you can see that this searching heart that comes up empty with the world, that, you know, he has a kid out of wedlock, he lives kind of a wild life, it doesn't make him happy. That is a pretty normal story, that worldly pleasures and worldly philosophies can't satisfy. There's something else that needs to be healed and converted in the heart. Does that seem like it might fit the text that you're looking at?
I mean, I guess. I wasn't really sure. I thought that at first it sounded like he was saying, like, almost you could pick someone out on the street and be, like, watch them for, you know, a couple of days and be like, oh, that's a person who's, like, on the verge of metanoia based on, like, what they're doing. And
you,
it sounded,
I mean,
odd to me.
You
I didn't know if there was, like, a
kind
list
of mathematical
in, like, the church fathers.
Right. You can't in any mathematical sense. I think the most you can say is you can see somebody who clearly seems to be searching. And that many times when you see someone on that kind of search, they end up becoming Christian. You know, people say this about Jordan Peterson all the time. He's asking the kind of questions a person asks before they convert.
Andy, I'm going to leave it there because I got to take the break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, and we are off to a good start for Holy Week here. And if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, if you have any kind of question about Catholic faith, you want to know, you got something you want to know about Jesus, about the sacraments, about popes, whatever it is, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call here, 888-318-7884. We say uncomfortable things sometimes about moral issues, about Aztecs, and about baby boomers. So those are... Those are the things to watch out for. Let's go to Vince in upstate New York. I like that the caller specified upstate New York because that's a different thing than the other side. 1460 AM, Vince is listening on. Vince, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
No problem, yes. We have many people, when we say New York, they always think New York City, but New York is a lot more than New York City.
Yes, it is. It is a lot more, right? It's beautiful up there.
Yes, it is. It is. So, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. So in the Bible, there's various areas in the Bible, in the New and Old Testament, that says God hardened the people's hearts or God hardened somebody's hearts. And that's confusing to me because why would God want to harden your heart when he wants to attract everybody to him? You know, I could see if they said, you know, Satan hardened their hearts, but why would they say God hardened their hearts?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So there's two things to know. The first is that this usually comes up in the context of Pharaoh, that we're told that, you know, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And he says in Exodus 7, verse 3, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. But later it says in Exodus 8:15. That when Pharaoh saw there was a respite, he hardened his heart, meaning Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And then Exodus 8:32 said Pharaoh hardened his heart this time also. So the same action is being described in two ways, as God hardening Pharaoh's heart and as Pharaoh hardening his own heart. And the best explanation I've heard for this is that we can talk about the sun melting butter or hardening clay. But it's not that the sun really likes butter and really hates clay. It's that the butter and the clay react in opposite ways to the one and the same sun. And so Pharaoh reacts to one and the same message from God in an opposite way from Moses. That Moses responds by softening to God, and Pharaoh responds by hardening to God. And so we can talk about God hardening Pharaoh's heart, like we can talk about the sun hardening the clay, but we shouldn't miss the fact that it's actually not something in God, it's something in Pharaoh that's the problem.
Okay, yeah, it's confusing sometimes. I even seen it somewhere, I can't recall right now, in the New Testament, I've seen something like that too.
Yeah, absolutely, because Hebrews quotes this too. But again, it's the same concept that, you know, think about the sower and the seed, that the seed in one area produces great fruit, in another area it withers and dies. the problem is not in the seed. It's not that God gives good seed to one person and bad seed to another one. It's the same seed given to everyone, but in some cases we're receptive to it, and in other cases we choke it out. We prefer the cares of the world. We don't take it seriously. We have all these obstacles to receiving the seed, to receiving the word. But it is not that God gives one person good seed and one person bad seed, because God is only the source of goodness.
Okay, so in actuality, it's not really God, it's the person. They're hardening their own heart, is what you're saying, in a way.
I mean, God is presenting a message to Pharaoh that he knows Pharaoh is going to reject, and God is going to use his rejection for his own glory. But God doesn't make Pharaoh reject him. He acts knowing Pharaoh will reject him. And so we can say that God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Again, just like we can say the sun hardens the clay. But if you thought that there was something wrong in the sun, that it just had a certain property, that it was, you know, allergic to clay or something, that would be a misunderstanding. It's not that God has some weird personal animus against Pharaoh. No. He's one and the same God eternity to eternity. He doesn't have, like, weird grudges against individuals. And so we respond to him in different ways. He wants the same good for everyone. But some people are going to say yes, and some people are going to say no to one and the same message.
Okay, Vince?
Gotcha. Understand. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Absolutely. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Prescott, Arizona, where Isaac is watching on YouTube. Isaac, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yes. Thank you, Catholic Answers. My short question is, if a Catholic who is fulfilling, you know, their obligation to go to Mass every Sunday, should they or can they also perhaps attend a Protestant service, you know, maybe because they have family who are Protestant and who are inviting them? And if so, is that joining in schism, backtracking, you know, bring confusion, say if you're married and you have kids who you can also bring to that Protestant service? That's my question.
That's a really good question. And this is a question that's been very controversial among Catholics in the past. You already made a really important caveat in there. Protestant services don't replace the Mass. Simply put, like what happens at most Protestant services where you've got like a reading from Scripture and then somebody preaching on it, and then maybe some prayers or some songs, is basically what happens at a Catholic Bible study. You know, you've got a reading of Scripture, you talk about it, hopefully it's good, it may be bad, and then you pray about it, you sing about it maybe, and then you, you know, have some good fellowship and you go home. And so you can have a Catholic Bible study, you can have a mixed Catholic and Protestant Bible study, you can go to a Protestant Bible study. I was actually in a Protestant Bible study when I was living in Rome. I would, you know, kind of bring the Catholic perspective on things, but there's nothing inherently wrong with a Bible study. Bible study is good. You should watch out in a Bible study to make sure you're not getting wrong information, but it's not inherently wrong. As long as, again, as long as it's not replacing Mass. So what Protestants call church services, we would consider more like a Bible study. And so the standard is the same, that if you go, why are you going? If you're going, you know, for instance, because your spouse goes, or you're going for a wedding, or you're going for any of those things, that's totally fine. But again, don't forget your identity, don't forget who you are, and don't let it like disrupt your faith. If you hear some strange thing, maybe take it to your pastor, read up the catechism, call Catholic Answers if you need to. But that's the idea. It's not like inherently wrong. You're not suggesting this is equal to the Mass any more than if I go and pray with my neighbor, am I suggesting that's equal to the Mass?
Yes, and that makes total sense. I really appreciate that. If I could just get a little personal here, my wife and I, we're going to be joining the Catholic Church. We're going to be
welcome home, brother.
You know, receiving to the Catholic Church, on Easter, this coming Sunday.
Wonderful.
But you know, we have a Protestant family, like my in-laws. For inviting us to the Easter service. And it's just hard because, you know, when I was a full-on Protestant, then I come to believe in the Catholic faith. You know, I feel like, you know, if I was, you know, after proclaiming and professing the Catholic faith and within hours later go to a Protestant Easter service, it just feels like in good conscience, how can I do that?
If your conscience is troubling you, then don't do anything that you don't feel comfortable with. But I would say this. in Israel, there was both the temple and synagogues. In the temple, they had true sacrifice. The synagogue was not the temple, and it couldn't pretend to be. They did not have sacrifice. They didn't have worship in the fullest sense. What they had instead is people would get together and read scripture, and then there'd be some preaching on it. And Jesus went to the synagogue every week. Now, I don't think that means you need to go to a Protestant service every week. We have those same elements in the liturgy of the word in the right. Eucharist. But it's that idea that it's not the same thing, that Protestants aren't doing the same thing. But if you can go and get a beautiful proclamation of Jesus's resurrection from the grave, and you can avoid the error that this is the same thing or equal to the Mass, well, I can always use more confirmation of Jesus being risen from the grave and more encouragement in that area. And if right. in the process, maybe you can say, hey, I'd be happy to go with you. Why don't you come with me next week? And you can just go to both and then bring them next week. You can have kind of an evangelical outreach with it as well. That is one of those complicated issues. You are by no means the first person to deal with that. And so I would just say, follow your conscience in this, but you're not sinning if you say, I think I feel comfortable going to the Protestant service as well as the Catholic one.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And I have a beautiful brother-in-law who, you know, who told me, you know, he's inviting us to go to the Protestant service. And he said, you know, we share in the resurrection. You know, it's a yeah. Lutheran church I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. And, so it's probably like, actually man, very close in many ways. Yeah.
Right. But it's funny because it's within Lutheranism who, you know, Martin Luther, who protests against the Catholic Church. And I feel like, am I backtracking now? You know, am I going against the Catholic Church if I'm going, for crying out loud, to a Lutheran church? You know,
this is it depends why you're going. But in a case like this, you wouldn't be going because you're saying, I've got my doubts about Catholicism. Let me go here to see if they've got the fullness of the truth or something like that. You're being a good brother. It's not like you're going to like a Hindu ceremony.
I'm so excited. I can't tell you, I can't say how excited my wife and I are. And we have a 1-year-old boy who's also going to be Catholic, of course. But we're just so excited. But it has been a hard year. You know, we did RCIA. We're in RCIA, you know, since the past couple of months, since last year, September. And we've just been growing our Catholic faith. And we're so excited. But it's been troubling because we have friends who are Protestant and family members. And it hasn't been an easy year. So it's difficult to maneuver.
Well, Isaac, we'll ask our listeners to pray for you as you come into this critical week, a week that often brings all kinds of emotions up and can present difficulties to people. I'm not wishing that on you, but I know that there are other folks also approaching. And if people would pray for those who are coming into the church this week, just because of all this, it will be very helpful to them. Your prayers will be helpful to them. And Isaac, if you hang on, I'd love to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, and a copy of Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Good reading for the Easter season. Well, I'm going to move on now, though, because I got a lot of people on the line. Jared in Michigan listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. You are next, Jared. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about a mass we were at on Friday, and kind of an unusual situation. The mass started, and we got into the first reading, and it was really right after the mass started. It became clear the priest was having a medical emergency and wasn't going to be able to finish.
Okay.
So they pull him out, and then they said, we're going to continue with the prayer service. But then they went on with what really resembled a mass. They came out and they did the gospel, and they even passed out communion. And I was just wondering if that was the right approach, or, you know, what should be done in that situation.
Well, really? Can I just ask you before Joe answers, was there a deacon present?
No. So
okay.
What happened was a member of the parish came up and did the gospel reading and attempted a homily, and then acknowledged that, you know, obviously we can't consecrate, but we'll do communion. And then there's some disagreement. We all kind of remember it a bit differently. So one person remembers them taking the host out of the tabernacle, which would mean it was consecrated already, I believe. But another person remembers them bringing it out from sort of another room.
Oh.
So it would have been unconsecrated. So
That is a very important difference.
That is kind of an important distinction.
Either Jesus or bread.
But in this case, Joe, memory fails. So maybe you could just, when we come back, if you could kind of give a little outline of what can happen in those, you know, what the church would recommend to happen in those situations. Can you hang on a couple minutes, Isaac?
Of course.
All right. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jared's on the phone with an interesting question for Joe Heschmeyer about the priest became ill, was not able to continue with the Mass. I can't remember if it was a Sunday Mass, but we'll check in with Jared and ask him in a second. So here's what happened as far as Jared told us. After the priest had made his medically assisted exit, a member of the – there was no deacon present. A member of the – of the community there, finished the liturgy of the word by reading the gospel, gave what was apparently an attempt at a homily, and then distributed communion, but probably distributed communion. We're not sure of that point. Was it a Sunday Mass, Jared?
Yeah, sorry, I should have mentioned that. It was a daily Mass.
Oh, it was a daily Mass. Okay. Oh.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know that anything was done incorrectly here. So there is what's called a rite of distributing Holy Communion outside Mass with the celebration of the word. And for obvious reasons, everybody just calls that a communion service because that is
so much easier.
Yeah. Yes. And so, for instance, if you're bringing communion to those in nursing homes, then this is the rite you follow. And you don't have to be a priest or deacon. Now, you cannot consecrate the Eucharist, obviously, as a layperson, even as a deacon. But it has introductory rites. Then there are readings. There, if you are a priest or deacon, you can then give a homily. If you are a layperson, you can give a reflection. I wouldn't, but it's not forbidden. And then there's like you do the Lord's Prayer, and then there's the reception of the already consecrated host. So you basically do the parts of the Mass lay people can do, and that's in lieu of the priest being there. That happens when priests are on retreat, for instance. And or in a case like this is a great example where the priest has a medical emergency and at the last minute suddenly is unable to celebrate Mass, or maybe Mass was even beginning and then they have the medical emergency. So that would be the kind of context in which you would appropriately use that. It doesn't sound like any clear abuse happened. Now, obviously, you highlighted one thing. If they're bringing out unconsecrated hosts, well, you can't do anything with that. I mean, you can have bread, but go to breakfast then. You're not able to, you know, have the Eucharist. You see what I mean? Like, in this case, yeah. It's assuming you've got an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, either a priest, a deacon, an acolyte, or someone who is actually deputized or authorized to be a minister of Holy Communion.
Does that all make sense, Chair?
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. No, I was just, you know, it's unusual, so I was just curious if that was
it is unusual.
The right way to do it or not. Yeah.
It doesn't happen very, very, very often. It sounded like at least potentially it was all quite within the bounds of what should have happened.
And certainly for like a last minute sort of what do I do here sort of thing that the parishioners were facing, I think they handled that pretty well.
They did. All of that with the caveat that we don't know.
True.
If they,
that's a good point.
If they went to the tabernacle, but I'm going to let's just say they did. Then it does seem like they did all of this quite right. Emma in Kansas City, Missouri is next, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Emma, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
So my question is, when in Mark chapter 8, verse 22 through 26, Jesus heals the blind man at Bethsaida. Why does he do it twice? Why does Jesus do it twice? The first time, the man, when he places it over the man's eyes, it looks like trees are walking. Why does he do it a second time until he sees everything clearly?
Well, because he doesn't want him to look like trees are walking anymore. No, I'm kidding. No, that's kind of a superficial answer. Because I know the real question is, like, why doesn't Jesus just heal him immediately, right? Completely?
Does that seems like your question, Emma. Why does Jesus do this in stages? Why not just do it as he does with many miracles instantaneously?
Yes.
Okay. Joe?
Yeah.
Smart
so he
Alec.
Doesn't tell us. I have a theory about it, but it's just that. This is just my theory, that he's showing us that sometimes divine healing happens instantaneously and sometimes it happens gradually. Because I have found in my own life that there are times where I want God to heal me of something, you know, a struggle with sin or an area I want to grow in or whatever. And sometimes I see really quick results. And other times I see partial, right? I see some growth. I'm better than I was yesterday, but I'm not where I want to be. To not forget that that's still Jesus working, that he will work sometimes in big ways and sometimes in small ways. That's how I've always understood the passage. I may be totally wrong about that. That's how I've always understood it. And I think he seems to use this as a teaching moment to show that he can do the small healing or the big healing.
What do you think, Emma?
That sounds about right. When I tried asking my mom, she thought I should call in, but she had a theory too about testing maybe the man's faith.
Oh, whether the man would be like, "Oh, you can't do it," or just because the man does persist. And that would apparently be part of the lesson as well. He says, he tells Jesus, people look like trees walking. And then the thing is, Jesus persists as well. He doesn't say, hey, that's good enough for you.
Yeah, I think that's actually, I like your mom's take. I would say that it's not one or the other.
No.
That there's this real sense in which the man had the opportunity to pretend like everything was okay with a partial healing. And he has the faith to not do that. He doesn't get discouraged and say, well, if Jesus has only healed me this much, that must be all he's able to do. But nor does he try to put a good face on it and just say like, oh yeah, everything's okay, I'm fine. And I think those are the temptations we run into, that we tell God like, oh, I mean, yeah, like my pain's at a 5 instead of an 8, so I guess I'm healed.
Thanks.
And it's like, no, what if Jesus actually wants to heal you all the way?
Right, yeah. Emma, I think it's a wonderful question, and I think your mom did I like her theory. I am with Joe, though. I think there are probably many layers to this, because this is a very strange thing that Jesus did, and clearly he has a reason for why he did it, because it's not like any of the other miracles. He raises people from the dead with just a word. So here, clearly he could have done it however he wanted. Why did he do this one this way? And I really appreciate the question. Emma, if you hang on, I want to send you a copy of Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. We'll get that to you. If you want it, just hang on and we'll send it to you. I'm going to Dylan now in Aurora, Illinois, watching on YouTube. Dylan, thank you so much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. A little background on me. Long story short, I was an atheist for most of my life, the height of which was probably extreme nihilism. And thank God I gave my life to Christ roughly 3 years ago.
Praise God.
So I currently... Thank you. So I've played at many different churches as a guitar player. I currently serve as a musician at a non-denominational church and have played at many churches in the Aurora area. My question is, because I've been going through this process, I'd say roughly the last several months, but it's been very extreme in terms of my perspective switching about possibly converting to Catholicism. My main question is, if I were to convert to Catholicism, am I still able to work as a musician at Protestant churches? And to be clear, I do get paid for playing at these Protestant churches, so I wasn't sure if that extra layer of not only attending, because I know that's not necessarily an issue, but physically being a worker and, you know, getting a check from that church, I do know that it doesn't fulfill my Sunday Mass. I know it doesn't, I can't take communion at the other churches, but I wasn't sure if there's other restrictions I'm unaware of, or if I'm not even really supposed to do that. What do you guys think?
Oh, great question. As far as I know, there's nothing that would prohibit you from doing that. There is what's called the Directory for the Application of Principles and Norms on Ecumenism. Look, I don't name the documents. And it kind of outlines what the things you can do. And it talks about how, for instance, as a Catholic, you can be, you know, I was a groomsman for my Protestant roommate in college when he got married. That's acceptable explicitly. You're given permission to do that. And so if you can do all of that, if you can be a groomsman, you could certainly be the organ player, you know, like you could, you know, or the guitar player. You could bring the music if you can participate in the service in that way. But again, the caveats you mentioned, you can't receive communion and it doesn't replace Mass, are the important ones to remember. So the standard I mentioned, I don't know if you heard earlier, there was a caller with a somewhat similar question. I said, if you think about it almost like a Bible study, well, could you play music for a Bible study? Well, yeah. You wouldn't think it was, okay, therefore I don't need to go to church, I don't need to go to Mass. But you would just recognize this as imperfect as it may be in many ways, is an attempt to give glory and honor to God. The one caveat I would make there is, if there's a scandal by you being there, then you shouldn't be. And I don't foresee that being the case in your case. But for instance, if the church was notoriously anti-Catholic, or if the sermon was, you know, really anti-Catholic, or if the hymns were heretical, those would be things you'd want to be mindful of so that you're not doing anything to give a disservice to Jesus or to the faith.
Okay. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense, because in my mind, when I'm thinking more long term, I'd want to be in a leadership position to specifically avoid that, because I'm sure you know, especially with, like, you know, big evangelical churches, there's a lot of pretty wonky lyrics, to say the least, sometimes.
And so, you know, in any case,
I've heard some in Catholic churches.
Yeah, I was going to say, even in a Catholic church, you sometimes want to be like, I can't play this in good conscience.
Yeah, well, sometimes I'm singing, what am I singing now? I'm not exactly sure what I'm singing, and it's not the time to do theology, but yeah.
There are times I stay silent because I don't want to sing a hymn to myself.
No, I'm just saying I can't do that. I can't mentally do that in the context of the Mass, but you sound like you're on a beautiful path, Dylan. What a wonderful call. Thank you for that call.
Thank you. Do you mind if I ask a follow-up question about researching?
No, that doesn't sound like a follow-up question. That sounds like a completely new question that you're going into, Dallin. But you can ask it, sure.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So I guess, long story short with this one, too, I've been trying to look through, you know, different things that I agree or disagree with, because, you know, I was actually listening to Trent Horn. He said it shouldn't be the standard that once you accept mere Christianity, which a lot of apologists kind of kind of fight for, it doesn't mean you automatically should be a Protestant, automatically should be, you should be kind of in this middle ground discern from there. And that made me really think about where I was at. And it was actually watching, what's it called, Pints with Aquinas. And I learned that the view of the Eucharist was never viewed as non-literal presence, for lack of better terms, to like 1600 years later. And I was like, what? And I researched it and I was blown away that this is like a new phenomenon, and along with many other things. And I'm just wondering if you have any advice or research materials on trying to, you know, look at church history, because I've tried learning about, okay, what even is this Reformation thing, and, you know, why am I even a Protestant to begin with? I've changed my mind on a lot of things, but, you know, I'm still trying to figure a lot of this out, and it just feels like I have 2,000 years to sort through. It's kind of exhausting, to say the least.
I get you. No, that makes sense. If only there was a book called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, that would
be
news for you. I actually wrote a book with just that title that's exploring four issues, and I will send to you. It's looking at what did the early church believe about baptism, about the Eucharist, about bishops, and about the four Gospels. Now, obviously, that leaves a lot of area uncovered, but it points to the fact, I think that I'm looking at just the first 200 years of Christianity, and it's a pretty startling difference between what they believed and what the Protestants believe. And I think once you see that, it'll, you know, again, it won't answer every possible objection you could have, every possible question you could have, but I think it makes the difference between historic Christianity and Protestantism a little more stark.
Oh, yeah. Like, reading the Didache and St. Ignatius looks nothing like the 45-minute TED Talk and 45-minute rock concert sort of stuff that I've been kind of accustomed to as a Protestant. So,
yeah.
Well, Justin Martyr's another one you might read in that regard. Justin Martyr has beautiful descriptions of the second century liturgy. So, but let's I got to take
break. Yeah, we'll send you a copy of the book. And then also Philip Schaeff. No, it's actually not Philip Schaeff. It's A&F Volume 1. It's the Anti-Nicene Fathers. Schaeff does the Nicene Fathers. I don't know who does the Anti-Nicene. It might have been Hale. Anyway, if you look up A&F Volume 1, it's the earliest Christians just in their own words. And it's just translations of their writings. So you can just read them for themselves as well.
Just real quick, Joe, do you remember the thing? I know you can get it on Jimmy Akin's website, but he wrote a thing for an exercise for evangelicals on the Catholic Church.
I'll tell you this.
If Dylan, hang on and I'll find it for you. No, you don't have to hang on. Just give your address so we can send you Joe's book. But then when we come back from the break, I'll get the title of what Jimmy wrote, the exercise for evangelicals on Catholicism. Hang on, give us your address. We'll be right back with more Open Forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of...
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, and I am looking for Jimmy Akin's article. I will find it. I know that if you go to jimmyakin.com and search there, I'm not sure about the search function, but you can find an exercise for evangelicals, but I'll find the full title of it for Dylan. So don't worry, Dylan, it's coming. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, and it's an open forum. And up next is Rial in Portland, Oregon, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Rial, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Happy to.
I have Mormon friends, and I don't quite understand the entirety of their God complex, but when you're going back and forth about discussing, like, who is God, he is perplexed at the concept that God cannot create another God. And I try to research, like, explaining the logic behind why God can't create another God. And all I'm finding is Islamic videos, or can God create a rock that he cannot lift? And so if you guys have a good explanation, that would be great.
Great. So we have to start with, what do we mean by God? Oh, because there's two things we could mean by God. There's a book by David Bentley Hart called The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness, Bliss, in which Hart points out that we talk about God and the gods. And so if by the gods you mean like spiritual beings or even powerful spiritual beings, God could create gods in that sense. He did. We call them angels and demons. So if that's all you mean by gods, a spiritual being, by all means, God could make other gods, in quotation marks. But by God, we properly mean the infinite, uncreated creator of everything. And the reason that's confusing for Mormons is they don't believe in that God. They believe in just a powerful spiritual being who was created by another powerful spiritual being all the way back. But these gods don't actually have any God who created them. They're uncreated in some strange sense, but they're all created by one another. So I had the opportunity to talk to a Mormon lawyer that I knew who kind of presented this vision. And it was the idea, okay, Joseph Smith, in what's called the King Folliot speech, it's a funeral sermon he preaches for a guy named King, which is an amazing name. And he says, as we are, meaning men, he once was, as he is, God, we shall be. That God used to be a man on earth. That God the Father used to be like a guy who had his own God. And that God had his own God, and that God had his own God. And it just is like, well, you've got like God grandparents. You've got God the Father and God the grandfather and all the way back. And so I said, okay, so who's the oldest God? Who's the first one? That should be really easy, right? And there's no answer to that question. It's just an infinite regress. There's no oldest God. There's no first one. You just have a series of effects with no cause. Logically, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work at all. This is sometimes called turtles all the way down, based on a kind of funny anecdote about kind of the idea, well, the world is built on the back of a turtle, and that turtle is not just suspended in air, it's on the back of another turtle. And then you say, okay, well, who's that turtle on? And it's just turtles all the way down. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work. There's no support that gives rise to any of these things. So you need a capital G God. You need an uncreated God. Well, if you have an uncreated God, he can't create another uncreated God. It's right there in the definition. Like, a created being is not the infinite uncreated God. So that's why there can be only one uncreated God. Is that helpful? Does that make sense? Like, this is why we reject Mormonism as not really being monotheistic, and arguably kind of being atheistic, that it doesn't really believe that there is a divine creator of everything. It just believes we happen to live in a universe with spiritual as well as non-spiritual beings.
Yeah, no. Yes, that does make sense, especially from, you know, at least the Christian perspective, most of the Catholic perspective.
Yeah, I just but mean, you've used it from a logical perspective. A thing that exists either exists of itself or it was created by another. And you can't just have an infinite amount of things that require something else to exist. This is St. Thomas Aquinas' third argument called contingency. And the idea is, you know, I'll use the example of a train. A boxcar doesn't move itself, but it moves the car behind it. The engine moves all of the cars, including itself. You can't just have an infinite number of boxcars or the train doesn't move. You need an engine. You need something that's an uncreated, uncaused cause and creator of everything else. And that we call God.
And that is where I will have to leave it, Rial, because we have still have lots of folks on the line. I just want to say, why be Catholic? An exercise for evangelicals. Jimmy Akin, that's for Dylan. The piece that I was mentioning, Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals by Jimmy Akin. You just put that into your search thingy and it'll get you there. Let's see who we've got next. Charles in Montreal, Canada, watching on YouTube. You are up next, Charles. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yes, hello, guys. I'm really happy to be able to talk to you as I'm about to do confirmation this Saturday.
This is kind of exciting.
Welcome home, brother. This is a great week.
This is a great week. I'm so glad you're here, Charles. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yes, awesome. Representing my French folk, Francophone folks in the
Yes.
In Quebec, there in Montreal. So really glad to be able to talk to you. My question is easy, but I might have a second fault. So here it goes. Can I take communion twice in a day?
Great. This is actually a really straightforward answer. Under the 1983 Code of Canon Law and Canon 917, you can if one of two things happens. Either number one, you're in danger of death. You know, you go to mass in the morning, you slip on the ice on the way out. I'm assuming ice all year round in Canada. Maybe that's not true. And you go to the hospital and you're potentially dying and someone brings you communion in the hospital. You can receive that.
Okay.
But if that's not the case, if you're, you know, not in danger of death, the other condition is if you are within the Eucharistic celebration, like participating. So if you go to mass twice, then that's fine. You can receive the second time. So like, let's say the first time you have someone bring you communion in the hospital and then you get better and you decide, I'd actually like to go to mass and make an act of thanksgiving. Then you can actually receive the second time because you're participating in the Eucharistic liturgy. That makes sense? So the second time, the question is, am I participating in the Eucharistic liturgy or not? There used to be rules about like what time did you get there? Were you there before the gospel? All this. It's really easy now. Are you participating in the Eucharistic liturgy for the second time or are you not?
Like meaning like reading verses or something?
No. So good question. Just like, are you actually at mass? So you couldn't just have like a communion service where somebody came to your home and gave you the Eucharist the second time if you've already received.
Okay.
It has to be in time. The context of the Mass. You don't have to be doing anything at the Mass.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, understood. Yeah, because basically, yeah, okay. That's great. I want to assist a Roman Rite, Latin Mass in Montreal. And also sing also in another celebration the same day. So I'm wondering about that.
Which one is first? Because that actually matters. Which one would be, which one is second?
Second is a regular mass in my neighborhood church.
Yep, totally fine.
Okay.
All right, Charles.
I see. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's wonderful news. God bless you. And I'm sure many of our listeners are praying for you now as you approach your confirmation in the Catholic Church.
Thank you so much.
I like you.
You too.
It's twice a day. You're going to overtake some cradle Catholics pretty soon here.
Oh, yeah, without question. I think the interesting thing about that, Joe, is that many Catholics don't know that you don't have to go to Mass to receive communion. I know many Catholics who don't know that. If you happen to be walking by the church and they're distributing communion and you haven't made it to Mass today, you can receive communion.
Yeah, it's highly recommended that you receive the Eucharist within the liturgical context of the Mass. But yes, it is technically true.
Joe Heschmeyer, thanks. You helped us out today because another apologist wasn't able to make it, and I know we took you away from other things you had to do, and I know you're an RCIA teacher, so you have lots of folks this week that I'm sure you're praying for and looking forward to accompanying.
Yeah, please, everyone listening, pray for the Our Lady of Good Counsel in Kansas City, RCIA crew, the people coming into the church, both now and then Divine Mercy Sunday.
Thanks, Joe, and if I don't see you between now and then, a very blessed Triduum and a happy Easter to you and your whole family.
Hey, thanks. Even if I don't see you, I hope you have one as well.
All right. You know what I mean, though, Joe, when I say that. All right. 2 hours open forum tomorrow. We'll see you, God willing, right then on Catholic Answers Live.